Come on in. Next matter on our oral calendar is in the matter of the welfare of the children of FKO and MLO JRB parents. Council, as you're getting situated, I will just ask you, in light of the fact that we have multiple briefing in this case, has there been some discussion of division of time?
Yes, with respect to the two appellants, we will, it's our intention to divide that time as equally as possible for the appellant's oral argument time.
So there's a couple of ways we can do it. We could just leave the clock set for 15 minutes and leave it up to you to, when one person stops, the other person will stop the clock and we'll continue from there. Or we can just set the clock for 7.5 minutes, whichever you prefer, and we'll...
I think we can just leave it set for 15 and navigate the best that we can, so...
Yes. All right, so if you take up too much time, somebody's going to owe somebody lunch probably, but... okay, fair enough. So appellants, together you'll have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional 5 minutes, and you can choose who makes the rebuttal argument, or if you'd like to divide that as well, entirely up to you. Counsel for respondent, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument entirely. The timing restrictions are indicated in the light and clock in the lectern, and there's a button in front, and you can raise or lower it to your height for your convenience. I'm assuming that you're going to use that button.
I'm going to need to lower that.
All right. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of it for the audience.
Perfect. Thank you.
And counsel for appellant, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. Attorney Carrie Doom here on behalf of the appellant mother in this matter. This court has repeatedly recognized that there is no more grave and weighty matter that comes before it than a review of a petition to terminate a parent's parental rights. The severing of the parent-child relationship, a relationship that my client has a substantial and fundamental right to protect, is not something that should be severed lightly, but only for things that have been recognized as being grave and weighty reasons. Here in this case, one of the significant issues that kind of permeated this case was what the agency perceived as mother's inability to regulate her emotions, particularly though in the context of dealing with the social workers in this matter. However, I think we have to look at that social worker-mother relationship from the lens of the fact that from mother's perspective, this was an agency that failed her from the beginning. From her perspective, failed her from the outset of the case when they allowed the children to be vaccinated without her consent. Then, when mother was repeatedly expressing concerns about the children coming to visits with bruising and other marks, developed a plan for incident reports to be done so that mother wasn't thinking worst case scenario that her children were being abused in foster care. But what does the agency do with that? They disregard that. They don't follow through on that. And then they hold it against mom when she comes to visits and has an emotional reaction to her children having bruising and making remarks about things that are happening. And this was the agency as well that failed her in saying, you need to develop reflective capacity. Reflective capacity is a term that's used throughout this case. That mom, you need to develop reflective capacity. And how is mom supposed to develop that reflective capacity? Family therapy, and parenting skills. And what does the agency do to provide reasonable efforts in that regard? Let's first look at family therapy. The first time that family therapy services were even sought out for this family was 11 months into this case. It aligned with the timing of filing of a permanency petition. The area that was most of grave concern to Isani County Health and Human Services. Was mom developing reflective capacity? And where is she supposed to learn that reflective capacity? Family therapy. And we don't even have a start making efforts to find a therapist till 11 months into this case. And then let's intensify that further.
Isn't there a finding that Mr. Zorb, if I'm pronouncing that name correctly, began efforts to locate a family therapist in July 2023?
So the family therapy efforts in July of 2023, yes, that would have been 11 months into the case because the case began August of 2022. So those efforts began in July of 2023. 11 okay. months into the case when a permanency petition had already been filed. Then, to complicate and either further make this matter hard when it comes to the family therapy, is finally in December of 2023, in the middle of trial, a family therapist is finally identified and willing to work with the family, and the agency doesn't move forward with that family therapy because they weren't satisfied with the release signed by my client. And I want to make it known that this was a release that just was needed to make the referral, to contact the therapist to say, can you do this? And my client signed a limited release. It didn't release to this agency all of her entire psychological records, didn't release all of her medical history, all of this private information, because we're just making a referral. And what does the agency do with that? The agency is just like, fine, we're not going to make the referral. We don't like the release you signed. We're not going to make the referral.
I'm sorry, going back to the family therapy, mm-hmm. The case plan wasn't developed until... correct me if I'm wrong, but you said that was July 2023 was 11 months into the case. But it appears the case plan was developed later than August 2022.
Yeah.
So, and the question here, the findings in the district court's order relate to the case plan. So, help me understand why you're focusing on August when the case plan was adopted much later.
Yes. So first of all, the case plan wasn't adopted until March 1st of 2023 because of significant delays that happened with respect to first getting to the initial adjudication of the child protection matter. And so that's the first piece. Then we had a switch. The judge had to recuse herself, so we had a new judge come on board. And even though the case plan wasn't ordered until March 1st of 2023, or actually March 3rd of 2023, the agency actually had an obligation to file that case plan within 30 days of the removal of the children in August and to begin working that case plan. They hold mom to the standard that you have 11 months before permanency is filed to, engage in the services. They don't get to then turn around and say, well, the case plan wasn't ordered until March, and so that gave us 5 additional months before we had to start doing what we needed to do. The agency's obligation to engage in reasonable efforts began the day they removed those children from the home. And waiting 11 months to make a recommendation for family therapy in that situation when that was the most critical component to this case. This case was about mom's ability to recognize her children's needs and to regulate her emotions. That's what this case was about, and the most critical pieces to that were family therapy and parenting skills. They had the parenting skills started in shortly after the children were removed, and I believe in about October of 2022 before the case plan was ordered. But then in February of 2023, they stop the parenting skills work and never again resume that parenting skills work. There were significant failures by this agency to engage in reasonable
parenting skills work that was stopped because of, wasn't it your client's behaviors?
So there, yes, the parenting skills work was initially terminated when visitation terminated. However, They did not take any steps to identify any other parenting skills work that could be done while they were waiting to reestablish visitation, nor did they have a plan in place for how that trajectory of visitation was going. They were saying, you need to do parenting skills work, but we're not going to provide you the visitation or the services or the resources that you need to do that parenting skills work.
And you're saying that behavior was a lack of reasonable efforts.
That's yes. Where, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I'm saying. The agency here had an obligation to engage in real, genuine efforts. And I think as you look through the history...
How does that interplay with your client's behavior, particularly looking at the releases of information? I think part of, as I read the record, the issue was that your client would sign releases and then revoke them, only sign partial releases and then revoke them. Individual therapy, she'd go and then she wouldn't go, and there were multiple therapies over this period of time. Why isn't that reasonable efforts if they are allowing her an ability to go to therapy, individual therapy, and that's not working, particularly where they're looking to the individual therapist to get recommendations regarding the family therapist?
Well, first of all, with respect to the individual therapy component of it, she was engaging in individual therapy. There may have been some transition in services providers, and that's not an uncommon situation, but we do see...
Does the record also reflect that she didn't attend a number of therapy sessions?
There was a gap in time where there's maybe some therapy sessions missed, but I think of critical importance is as we look at, and the critical time is at the time of the hearing, and as we were at trial in this matter, she had the testimony is... was that she had engaged consistently in therapy for 5 months with the same therapist. And so while there may have been some intermittent periods of transition of therapists, what we do see is that once she had her parenting assessment done and the services were recommended from that parenting assessment, she moved forward in complying with those recommended treatments. I do see that I need to defer now to counsel so he has an opportunity as well. Thank you.
Thank you. You can stop the clock while we're changing counsel.
May it please the court,
counsel.
A lot of what was touched on by Ms. Doom, same things I want to look at, reasonable efforts. It's different for, and I apologize, I'm Bryce Norton for appellant father.
Thank you.
I'm sorry for that. It's different for my client, though, because there was really no real genuine assistance for my client at all. They made one attempt to really even have contact with him, and after that point, it was basically communication through appellant mom, as going through everything for both of them. They really weren't providing him with anything on that front. A big part of this too as well, I touched on in the brief, is the best interest component here for my client and specifically for his child CSO. At the time of the trial, which is the pertinent part, appellant father, my client, was having real progress in his relationship with CSO, with his child. That was evidenced in the testimony from the therapist and what was happening at that point. There was testimony that there was obviously a bond between them, and there was an interest in maintaining that. We obviously have to look in best interest at interest in preserving the parent-child relationship, but for the child and both and for the parent, and then any competing interests of the child. There was testimony and no real argument that my client was attentive and concerned for his child and that there was an obvious bond. I don't believe that it was in the best interest of the child or my client for that to be severed. I also want to touch on one thing that's different in my case, as see from the brief, is I did make argument on ineffective assistance of counsel. And that touches on the relationship between my client and his child as well, as evidenced through his therapist and her testimony that was coming through and saying that There had been real progress between them that he was, during the case at some times, this young child had referred to the parents as the bad guys. And at the point of the trial, they had made the progress with my client. He was no longer the bad guy. They had a good rapport with each other, and he was doing well in caring for her, or for him. And there was testimony from that therapist evidencing this part, and they were no longer the bad guys. And trial counsel at that particular point, Mr. Pepin, did nothing to expand on that, did nothing to do further, let the court know what was meant by that relationship. Now, so that was 3 days of trial with Mr. Pepin. For the fourth day, there's a gap between that of December of 2023 for another 3 months when a new attorney came on the case. And there's no indication that at any point he requested any kind of transcripts to look at and know what actually happened during the time of the previous 3 days of trial, three long days of trial. Now, I think it obviously would have been something had I been placed in that position that I would have subpoenaed and recalled that therapist and delved into that relationship that was building and budding there. But not only did that not happen, he didn't even look at what had happened prior. And I don't know how he could have possibly been prepared for that day at that point. And I know one of the things that was countered by the county is that, well, that was at my client's own doing. My client was the one that fired Mr. Pepin and hired Mr. Anderson, so he shouldn't be able to say, well, any kind of argument there. You were the one that chose that. But it should have been inquired of my client whether he fully understood what that would mean and fully acknowledged that. There's no indication that they talked to him about that on the court and really fleshed out that, hey, you're bringing somebody in brand new to this. Is this truly what you want to do? Listen, that is my argument. I see my time is running up, so.
Well, I'll extend another minute to you if you'd like. We did go over quite a bit with your co-counsel. If you'd like to continue or if you're finished.
No, I am good.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Tim Nelson. I'm the Chief Deputy Isani County Attorney appearing today on behalf of Isani County Health and Human Services. The key overarching issue here from the county's perspective is that this is a substantial record, and there's an order following trial here before this court that reflects substantial engagement by the district court judge, the trial judge, with this case throughout. The trial judge had the opportunity to manage this case over the period of time leading up to trial. There were five hearings that particular judge handled prior to trial. Trial included nine witnesses. There were eight credibility findings that are included within the trial court's order. It's a 31-page order, 179 findings of fact covering engagement with in excess of 200 exhibits. And again, as this court, of course, is well aware, the task is not necessarily to review this record de novo, to look back and reweigh evidence, deal with any potential conflicts in evidence, but to decide whether there was a sufficient basis for the district court to reach the result that she did. Our view is that a record this voluminous is always going to have elements to draw out for appellants.
This is a very large record. I guess the first question I have is, in looking at the district court's order, there are quite a number, overwhelming number of findings which relate to mom's relationship with the department and that frayed relationship.
Sure.
What are we to make of that number of findings in light of a number of the things that mom had done well, like she was in counseling for 5 months. There were 10 items that she was supposed to do in her case plan. A number of them were either not priorities or she got them done. And in looking at the number of things to do on her case plan, it seemed to me like she was making progress. What is this court to make of the fact that it seems records showed that mom was making progress, but the order seemed to focus on mom's obviously hostile and frayed relationship with the department?
Sure. And so if I'm following the question, certainly wouldn't be within the bounds for the agency to pursue a termination because they have a fight or because they don't have a good relationship with a parent. As opposing counsel, I think, ably points out, that in some way is baked in these cases. There's going to be tension based on what's happened there, based on the fact that there's been a removal or a case at all. I think I'd respond maybe in three ways. One would be first on the question of that tension. I would underscore that this wasn't ordinary garden variety tension between a parent who's had a child removed and a social services agency. And I think the record reflects it really going much beyond that. The testimony that's described in the court's order, the findings from the court on this describe the workers recalling that every phone call would end with yelling and swearing back and forth. There were threats associated with the children of the social workers. There was a specific threat to make a false allegation of a significant personal crime on the part of one of the social workers. And so again, not necessarily just somebody that has understandable tension or understandable concerns or disagreement, but really something reflecting an egregious elevated level of hostility and anger. And I guess the second part I would add to that is that it's not a matter of there being that tension and then things essentially being tranquil otherwise. And one event I would bring into focus that I think really draws this out is the February of 2023 visit that Your Honor had mentioned. If you go through the findings with respect to what happened then, that wasn't a matter just of yelling at social workers. It wasn't a matter of just expressing hostility or anger towards social workers. Some of the most concerning elements of that day was the anger expressed toward a child. At some point, as the district court recounts, there's an offer on the part of FKO to show the workers how to physically drag a child to a visit. There's negative blaming, yelling toward the child. There's an exclamation at some point, well, just give me the TPR. And so that's not just, again, anger that's directed, toward the agency. That's involving the children. And I think maybe if I had to identify one of the most telling and most concerning elements of the record as a whole is that, there's this question of MLO and his involvement and how engaged he's been throughout the course of the case. But at that incident, they talked to him about what happened. And the response is essentially that, well, the children are used to this. And so we have that incident, but we also have, we've got children who each are diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, each in individual therapy with individual therapists recommending that they need ongoing individual work. And you have an incident like that, which is memorable in reviewing the record, and then to have a comment from a parent that, well, essentially this may not be unusual. Or it may not be.
Counsel, that was in February 2023.
Sure.
I think the district court's findings reflect that that mother and father and the youngest child were having visits in the first three months of 2024, and that mother, there was significant. Mr. Zorb reported that there was significant improvement in the visits and that mother had not had any instances of being dysregulated during the visits. So given that and given mother's participation in therapy, are you relying too much on that February 2023 visit to support your argument here?
Sure, thanks. So the time period afterward. So a couple things that...
The analysis, that the court's undertaking in terms of the factors is looking forward as well.
Certainly. So a couple things that I think are kind of there in plain sight that I just want to really amplify. And so one is that there's this question about chemical health through this case. And that wasn't just picked out of the air by the agency. The parenting assessments, which are trial exhibits 47 and 48, both recount the parents describing to the assessor a history of chemical use, including specifically a history related to methamphetamine, particularly for MLO, recounting having, in his words, been hooked and describing regular weekend use of that substance. And those parenting assessments then did yield diagnoses of stimulant use disorder. The assessment at the time was that in remission, but a history there that I think justified the agency in thinking in this complex case, here's a factor we want to make sure we're on top of and we want to make sure isn't driving some of the conflict and the tension that's happening throughout the case. And so, I mean, just to put it really starkly, there is nearly wholesale unwillingness to engage in any kind of testing to help the parents establish sobriety to answer what I think was a reasonable question from the agency with all this conflict, with all these things happening. Could it be that that's, you know, one of the factors that's driving?
Didn't she take 8 tests over the period of time, and of the 8 failed, I believe, 1, which means she was negative on 7 tests and also got a chemical health assessment. So again, while we're talking about this chemical use concern, while I agree that the record shows that mom was pretty hostile towards the agency about ongoing testing, in fact, she did test. In fact, she was negative 7 of the 8 times, and she went to treatment. So I'm trying to understand, why are we focusing, or what focus should we put on the chemical health when it seems, particularly from mom's perspective, that she tested, was negative, and did a treatment as asked through her case plan?
I think that the testing record reflects essentially a parent sort of choosing when they're going to engage with that and then withdrawing. And so there are months that are identified within the record where there's a period from the middle of 2023 till nearly the end of the year where there isn't any testing. And then during January and February of 2024, again, there isn't any testing. And so certainly, you know, as I'd mentioned earlier, a record like this, there are going to be elements that are positive for a parent, and those negative tests are positive things for a parent. I think the concern for the agency is that if that's not consistent over time, and particularly when there are those large gaps, is that really providing any kind of guidance about whether there's sustained sobriety over time? And one piece I would add as well is that because of the unique timing of the trial in this case, the parents had the opportunity to sit in trial in October when the trial began, and they heard testimony from the social workers expressing their concerns about testing and about UAs, and that would have been an opportunity, you know, to sort of hear in the middle of the trial, this is a concern, this might be an issue, and might, you know, have led someone to, you know, call the agency the next week and say, you know, I'd really like to get this taken care of or get on top of this as the trial proceeds so I can take that issue out of play, you know, but that didn't happen. And the other piece I want to make sure I get
can
to
I say
as
a
well.
Question? Am I correct that father tested only once?
One time.
What was the, and it was a positive test?
It was.
What was the relationship and timing between mother's testing and father's single test?
Father's test was on April 17th, 2023. I believe mother's test was late March of 2023. And there also is a police report that's described in the court's findings from April 2nd of 2023, where law enforcement was present in the family home and believed from what they saw that there were indicia of use and believed that MLO may have been under the influence when they were present in the home.
Were they charged?
There were no charges that came out of that, no. But I do want to make sure I put it in the context of the entire case, so that the chemical health piece is not, you know, the sole thing here that the agency is presenting as you know, the single thing that essentially establishes this case on its own. If that were the only thing, we would have a different case. And part of the task of the district judge here was to reconcile that, at times partial compliance with the rest of the record. And to answer Judge Cochran's question, you know, so with respect to the mental health piece, so you have, as has been surfaced here, engagement with an individual therapist, and then what the court characterizes as no call, no show, incidents leading to discharge from one therapist, from another therapist, and then engagement with a therapist that had essentially made it clear early on that they couldn't be or wouldn't be a partner to the agency and sort of being a conduit of information. There is additional attendance at individual therapy appointments that happens very late in the case, but I think the district court describes it as 11 therapy appointments essentially from late 2023 through March of 2024. And I think the district court could fairly have had some concern about whether that was really sufficient, both in terms of the lateness of that and also in terms of just the frequency of that.
Of the multiple bases for the district court's decision to terminate parental rights, which does the county feel is the strongest, and what is the most significant evidence in support of that particular basis?
Certainly. I think that of those bases, B2 would be the one I would identify as potentially the strongest. I do think the evidence overlaps for the different statutory bases. I think that the critical evidence there is the, you know, for MLO, the wholesale failure to engage in the chemical health testing. For FKO, the only partial engagement with chemical health testing. With respect to mental health, the limited engagement over the course of the case with mental health resources in a situation where there were profound needs at the beginning.
But I do see your time is up. I do want you to address appellant's argument, particularly about the failure to file the case plan within 30 days and the gap of 11 months before even addressing family therapy and whether or not that is reasonable efforts on behalf of the agency.
Sure. So the case plan was ordered at the end of the initial trial. It was developed at an earlier time, but there wasn't an adjudication that the children were in need of protection or services till either February or March of 2023.
But case at that time, were they removed by that time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. And so I don't know that there's an issue raised you know, on appeal here about the timing of the filing of the case plan. Again, I think the court didn't go to the step of ordering it until there'd been an adjudication. So you have March of 2023, you have the case plan. And so the question of family therapy, you know, is not necessarily in the county's view, and I think in the district court's view, just a question of there's this thing that may be helpful, how soon can we do it, but an element that interacts with other parts of the case. And so if you have children who have mental health needs, if you have parents who have individual mental health needs, when you're talking about family therapy, you're talking about are people in a position to come into the same room and make productive use of that time and for that to be a good, safe, supportive experience for the children. February of 2023 was when the incident happened at the agency that we've discussed prior. Certainly would reasonably have been a factor that the agency and the court would have considered in sort of assessing how quick after that family therapy could plausibly happen. And then with respect to the timing after that, the district court explicitly finds the social worker credible in his description of his efforts after that to find a family therapist to do this work. Talks about him calling days upon days to try to identify a therapist. And I think a piece that is critical there too is that it's not necessarily a matter of you know, just calling a therapist and they're obligated to essentially take the case if they get a call. There's going to be a back and forth there about the case, whether a family therapist is able, willing to do it, whether they feel prepared or like they have the expertise. based on the complexity of it. And so I think, you know, the district court had the opportunity to hear testimony about that issue and essentially found it reasonable what the agency had done to try to get that family therapy in place. And there were, you know, plenty of pieces in the record that would have supported there being caution, you know, and not moving to that step when there were other parts of the case plan related to sobriety, individual mental health that hadn't been adequately addressed. I see my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent. Will both parties be providing rebuttal argument or just one?
We were both going to, so I will be brief with my time. Thank you.
You want the same treatment before, as before? We'll just set the clock?
For yes, that works.
Full time? All right, and you watch the clock.
Thank you. I want to pick up first on this piece about the excuse I want to offer that's being provided as why family therapy didn't get started, and talking about the fact that there were other components and that the kids needed to be ready for that. What's deeply concerning to me about that argument is that the children's therapists were saying throughout the case, family therapy needs to be occurring. Parenting skills work needs to be occurring. That recommendation was consistently being made by the children's therapists throughout this case, from the time that they began working with the children in October of 2022, that recommendation was being made. And the fact that the incident of February, and that recommendation didn't change because of the incident in February of 2023. What that incident in February of 2023 should have been signifying is we need more services for this family. We need to get that parenting education going. But they don't. They stop the parenting education. They should have said we need to get that family therapy going. But they stop, and they don't engage. They don't even make efforts to engage in that. There also continues to be this theme about my client.
Well, you're arguing that the children's therapist thought that family therapy made sense, but the district court found in paragraph 26, finding 26 on page 11 of 31, that with regard to the youngest child, the therapist testified she did not want to bring the parents into her sessions with the child because the therapist's office had become a safe space for the child, and she did not want to bring trauma triggers into their sessions.
And so
that finding seems to be contrary to what you're arguing here.
I would disagree, because that finding was about the child's individual therapist serving as the family therapist. She was saying, I don't want to be the family therapist,
right,
but we need to be doing family therapy. And so that was the piece. And if we look even at, and that was the youngest therapist was Dr. Lisa Noss-Tollefson, and she testified that as early as January or February of 2023, she was recommending family therapy for CSO and the biological parents. And that
Isn't that, though, dependent on mother evidencing reflective capacity?
Mother is not able to do that reflective capacity unless she is engaging in that family therapeutic work. And Dr. Lisa Noss-Tollefson also had very little engagement with
mom.
What
are you relying on to argue that? I mean, couldn't she do that through her own therapy?
Both therapists testified that that was a dual part, that there's a part of it that you're going to have to do in your individual therapeutic work, but also in the work that you're doing in the family therapy. And mom was engaging in her individual therapy, and I think that's what's, again, there continues to be this idea that mom wasn't engaging in individual therapy, but I think what's important to highlight, and this is coming from the own testimony of Dallas Zorb, the social worker, is that he testified that mom was actively and consistently participating in her EMDR therapy. She was also continuing to work with her individual therapist and had maintained continuing contact and visitation for more than 6 months. And I just briefly want to just also kind of follow up on the point about the fractured relationship between the agency and my client. That was a pivotal thing throughout this case that became the focus, and it shouldn't have. And one of the things that we have to look at here in mom's situation is that hostility, that anger, that was directed at the agency, but the other professionals working with this family didn't see that. The school social worker, the children's, the two older boys' therapists, the parenting assessor. Those people who mom was also working with, who there wasn't this trust violation with, mother had consistently demonstrated an ability to engage and regulate her emotions. This time I'll defer to appellant's other counsel.
Thank you. I just wanted to touch on a couple of quick things, and I'll start with the fractured relationship part, because I think that Ms. Doom laid that out very well, that was something that was focused on throughout the case and leading up to the trial and the trial itself. At the time of trial, it seemed that my client was doing well in regulating, and he had basically become the person that was doing the supervising and doing trying to do what he can to make sure that everything was going well with mom. But briefly, I want to touch on the one positive test and the one indication where he might have been impaired for my client. I would indicate that the Supreme Court reversed the district court's termination of parental rights based on a parent's failure to maintain sobriety, finding no evidence that the parent consumed drugs or alcohol during the visit, the substance use was related to the parent's relationship with the child, or that the substance use rendered the parent unable to care for the child appropriately. The Isani County agency testified that an untold number of interactions with professionals, mandated reporters, medical providers, social workers, visit supervisors, there was no indication that my client was under the influence and that he was using. Additionally, acknowledged that my client was under probation with an obligation to test and that there were no probation violations to their knowledge at that time. So if it wasn't testing, there still was no indication he was using. Thank you.
Well, before you leave, when there's a case plan in place, it includes testing, and a party refuses to participate, isn't there a negative inference that's drawn from the refusal?
I believe that, I mean, yes, in the end, you should be following the case plan, you should be testing. I'd go back to the fracturing with
But I meant the negative inference being that if you don't test, the assumption is that the test would have been positive.
Sure, and that's why I brought up the indication that he was supposed to be testing under probation and there weren't any probation violations during that time. I guess I'd leave it to the court if they want to make that negative inference on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to all counsel. The matter is fully briefed. We appreciate your briefing and your oral argument in this case. You know, it's a difficult case. It always is in termination of parental rights circumstances. We're mindful of that. We will follow the law and apply the legal standard to issue our opinion, and we'll do so within the statutory period. Thank you, and good afternoon.
Thank you.